this case.
Harrington v. Commonwealth, James J. Illovich, Appellate Counsel, Robert H. Anderson III, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed. After Mr. Anderson gets organized.
May it please the court, my name is James Illovich. I'm representing Donald Harrington in a matter on appeal from the Circuit Court of Stafford County. This court granted hearing on four of the issues raised on appeal. As I contemplated getting ready for this hearing, I tried to figure out exactly what they're asking the court and where it all starts. And I guess where it starts is with the first issue, or the first assignment of error, which is the indictment. This matter began with Mr. Harrington being arrested on a criminal warrant. He was held in custody. He was given a preliminary hearing in August. That case eventually was certified to the grand jury by the judge. He was originally arrested on a warrant for possession with intent to distribute. The judge struck that language, certified it as just a simple possession charge, and it went to the grand jury of Stafford County. Somewhere between the warrant being certified as a possession warrant and the actual indictment that went before the grand jury, the Commonwealth amended that indictment back to possession with intent to distribute. The argument, of course, would be that that is unlawful because there's no statutory provision for it. In the case that was cited, I guess, and relied upon by the Court of Appeals at Ashby, and frankly the questions that were asked to me when briefing and being this case previously, was about supplanting and the Commonwealth being able to do certain things, and agreeing that the Commonwealth can do certain things. In this particular case, the Commonwealth could have directly indicted Mr. Harrington for possession with intent to distribute had it chosen to do so. But that's not what it did in this case. And when the hearing of this matter was conducted by counsel at that time, the Commonwealth didn't say, as the Commonwealth did in Ashby, that there were these types of indictments. I believe it was for carnal knowledge, and we wanted to emphasize other elements of the offense, so we indicted these other offenses under a different code section. This Commonwealth said that she did what she believed she was allowed to do, which is simply correct the, I guess, correct the warrant that went up to the circuit court so that she could indict for possession with intent to distribute. The argument, of course, would be that's not permitted by any case that I have read. I don't believe Ashby permits it, because even when you talk about supplanting, if you supplant something, you're supplanting it with something else, and in this case, there is no something else. The Commonwealth merely amended it. And when this issue was raised to the trial court for the first time, the trial court said that the Commonwealth was in its rights to do so. And, of course, that would be our argument about where the error of the trial court starts in this case, which is, can the Commonwealth, I guess, bring other indictments? Of course it can. Can it direct indict? Of course it can. I realized recently that I'm going to be in my 20th year of practice this year, most of it in criminal law, and I think now I finally know the ways to get to circuit court. It's to be arrested on a warrant, and you go through a preliminary hearing, and the charge is certified. You can be directly indicted by the Commonwealth attorney, and you end up in the circuit court, or you can do presentments or along with waivers of indictment to move things along. But there is, I've never heard of nor seen an instrument prepared in such a way as this one was. And the reason is because the things that flow from this, which would have to do with speedy trial, well, let's talk about speedy trial, I guess. That's significant. And in the case law, it actually addresses this matter. Armell, Ashby, we've already referred to, they do talk about why it's significant to look at how the charge begins. In other words, if it begins as it rests on a warrant, then speedy trial tolls from preliminary hearing. If it begins with the initiation of a new indictment, then speedy trial begins from service and then arraignment on the new indictment. But there is no hybrid there. There is no, I guess, way or mechanism for the Commonwealth to essentially extend speedy trial, at least not statutorily. And that's exactly, ultimately, what the decision of the Court of Appeals allowed.
Well, counsel, I know in your brief you call it an amended indictment, and I guess you're using the word hybrid. But just if you look at the piece of paper that's the indictment, what about it that, tell me what in the indictment, on the actual indictment, is inconsistent with what's required for an indictment?
Your Honor, I believe that statutorily the indictment is correct, and there are no defects, like 19.226 addresses a variety of types of defects an indictment might have, or the defects, I think more specifically that code section talks about the indictment's defects that would not render an indictment invalid. But in this case, Your Honor, I would say that this is not a direct indictment. And how do we know that? It's because part of the appendix, the papers that are right around the indictment itself, includes the warrant that went up. The Ashby case has a set of indictments that were never presented, I'm sorry, a set of warrants that were certified by the grand jury, but were never presented to the grand jury of that county. She merely brought direct indictments. And each of these cases talks about direct indictments. And even the Commonwealth's attorney in this case said, well, I can just add the word direct to that, facetiously, I guess. But that doesn't change, I guess if she had actually done that, if she had maybe not brought that charge forward, okay, fine, then we probably wouldn't have an argument. In other words, and it had the word direct indictment on a possession with intent to distribute indictment, then there is no issue. But she did not do that. And there is a significant, there's some significant fallout from her doing it the way she did.
Let me ask a question, if I may, because I'm a little confused by what you think the mistake was here and how this indictment was handled. You can have a preliminary hearing, say for felony shoplifting, and the judge feels that the Commonwealth attorney has not put forth probable cause on the value. So the general district court judge says, all you've got here is misdemeanor shoplifting. The Commonwealth attorney can say, well, thank you very much, Judge, and go next door to the grand jury and get an indictment for felony shoplifting. Can she not?
Would it be based on the document that was in front of the general district court? Or would it be a direct indictment or new paperwork, essentially? That's kind of what this is, paperwork.
So tell me how the paperwork was handled here. You agree, though, that the Commonwealth attorney could say, all right, Judge, I'm going to take my chances with the grand jury.
Yes.
Okay. So how does what happened here with the paperwork differ from that common situation I just outlined?
Well, I think the significant difference is, in some ways, it almost is, it thumbs your, it, the nose, or it's a thumbing of the nose at the general district court. Because as you point out, the general district court not only could say, I only find probable cause for petty larceny, but the general district court could try that petty larceny if everyone was in agreement to do so.
But the Commonwealth attorney doesn't agree because she wants to go to the grand jury and try to get the felony indictment.
And she would object, and I guess it would happen. But I guess my implication was, though, that the general district court judges actually do have some authority and some power. And in this case, I think you would all agree that the general district court can amend warrants and send them to the grand jury. So if that's a power that's vested in the general district court, then if the Commonwealth doesn't agree with it, I believe the procedure that it would rely upon would be one of two things. It would indict not only the indictments that went up, but in the alternative, indict other things. Like in this case, it would indict for possession, but it was also indict for possession with intent to distribute as a direct indictment. And I believe that is appropriate. I wouldn't disagree with that for a second, but that did not happen in this case. So the argument is, of course, that the Commonwealth attorney supplanted, I guess, the finding of the general district court judge by changing the instrument back from the amended warrant, which was about to become an indictment, to the indictment for felony intent to distribute, possession
so
intent to distribute.
So you're saying that with your paperwork argument, that the general district court judge scratched up the warrant and said, just possession. And that warrant went up to a grand jury?
Yes.
And then it was the possession with intent was written back in?
Yes, Your Honor.
Didn't the grand jury just issue a clean indictment?
Well, they issued an indictment based on what was presented to them, and who prepares those? The Commonwealth attorney prepares those. They were not given two different documents, and that would be the argument that the supplanting that's discussed in Ashby, and frankly Triplett and all the cases before that, is not applicable here because there's never a second charging document prepared. There's merely this amending. And why that's significant is because once you've changed this, as the Commonwealth attorney has, now according to Speedy Trial tolls not from preliminary hearing date, but from the date of the new indictment. And that's exactly what the Court of Appeals held in their decision on this case.
If the Commonwealth had prepared a second indictment to the grand jury? When would speedy trial begin to run?
I would say that it's still running from preliminary hearing until the grand jury either moves to dismiss or null pros that previous indictment. If they chose to have separate trials, I guess, or something like that, then the time on the second indictment, or I'm sorry, well, the second charge, the new direct indictment, would begin with that charge. If they were going to be joined, and this has happened sometimes, it has occurred to me, then there would be a motion to null pros the previous, objected to sometimes, sometimes not. That ends that charge as if it would have been null pros in the general district court, where they said the new process begins.
And speedy trial then begins to run from the indictment.
Correct. But I think there's some significance about those words, is that the legislature has differentiated speedy trial for people incarcerated and not incarcerated. And there's, I think, a reason for that. It's because it's not just moving cases along. It's that there's a real awareness of that the ultimate prejudice, I guess, someone charged with a criminal defense is they're not only under the cloud of a warrant or an indictment, but a lot of times they're being deprived of their liberty until their case is tried. Now, in this particular case, obviously, this gentleman was incarcerated for a whole period of time, but I think the precedential value of this decision would allow the Commonwealth Attorney to now sidestep the one, I guess there's a procedural safety net, even in the Commonwealth bringing additional charges, which is, all right, this charge has come through the General District Court. I've had my preliminary hearing. The Commonwealth seeks to direct indict on other offenses. That's still a separate consideration by the grand jury about these new offenses, whether it goes forward or not. And if they appear not to be appropriate or vindictive or whatever, the grand jury will hopefully act appropriately. If they're certified, now we're in circuit court with charges that probably have somewhere between around three months of speedy trial left and charges that have 5 months of speedy trial left. But it's still on the Commonwealth to sort that out through its motions, and then it's still on the trial court to make a determination about whether a motion to null pros is correctly granted, whether there's prejudice to the defendant. By allowing this, it simply just changes, it just resets the clock, essentially, and that seems to be a complete end run. And in the end, the precedential value of this case would be allow the Commonwealth to end run any incarcerated defendant's speedy trial started anew at the new charge. And they could do it, you don't just add a second indictment, they could take a malicious wounding and then change it into an aggravated malicious wounding. And the only reason they did so was to now add 3 months to speedy trial in circuit court. And surely that's not what the legislature intended. Obviously, the effect on this case for speedy trial purposes, if you start the clock when at the preliminary hearing, was it went up to the first scheduled trial date. This defendant wanted to go forward pro se. I've briefed what we thought was appropriate. We thought that the trial judge at that time should have at least gone through a colloquy with this particular defendant. The Commonwealth attorney chimed in, actually, and said, I know that this gentleman has represented himself previously. So she was actually on board with him trying his case that day in January. The judge said no. Argument based on that, though, is about 2 weeks later, the court-appointed counsel. Our argument would be that for speedy trial purposes, from the time that Judge Haddock said no, the trial judge that day, until the date the court appointed new counsel, because at that point he did accept counsel, and I think that the waiver in some ways of speedy, or the waiver of counsel argument falls by the wayside, but that time should not be told against him, as the judge said that day. He goes, who's this going to be told against? Said to you. He said, I want to go forward today. He did not agree with the continuance. The Commonwealth actually was in concurrence, and then that was by the trial judge at defense counsel's speedy trial motion after the Commonwealth's motion to continue agreed with that. I'd like to reserve the remaining time if possible.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Anderson for the Commonwealth. On this issue about the indictment, if I could make one procedural point first and then a merits point, go from there. The Court of Appeals, in upholding the indictment, offered an approach quite different from what had been debated back and forth up to that time. It cited two cases, this court's decision in Brooks v. Payton and its own decision in Ashby, to say that the indictment supplanted the finding of probable cause at the preliminary hearing. And the indictment in and of itself was certainly proper, and therefore there was no error. In his brief in this court, counsel offered not the slightest reference to the Court of Appeals' separate line of reasoning, didn't cite Ashby or Brooks, didn't say the Court of Appeals wrongly relied upon him. I pointed out all of that in my brief. He didn't file a reply brief where he said anything one way or the other about Ashby or Brooks or this notion about supplanting what had preceded it. He did talk today for the first time about Ashby. He did talk today for the first time about supplanting. I submit that that's too little, too late. When you have reasoning of the Court of Appeals that is sufficient in and of itself to dispose of an issue and it's not challenged thereafter, in this court's made clear that that is a default. I've just very quickly, Williams v. Commonwealth, which I've cited, Court of Appeals held two claims were defaulted. The assignment of error and the argument in this court is solely on the merits. Doesn't say word one about the Court of Appeals wrongly held the claims defaulted. This court held that under those circumstances, the merits argument was not before the court because the default ruling was, which potentially was dispositive, was unchallenged. Now, and also the Davis v. Johnson habeas case, I've cited the same kind of reasoning there. Now, counsel...
I found this to be intriguing as well when I was reading the briefs. But I wonder if it's because of the rule change, and I suppose we can ask him that. But do you think the rule change that we made makes a difference?
As to what precisely?
That you don't have to assign error to the Court of Appeals.
No, I'm sorry.
Specifically.
My argument, and I think I've said this explicitly in the brief of the Commonwealth, does not hinge on the assignment of error.
No, I understand
that. It hinges on the failure to present supporting argument. And this court, in numerous cases, I mean death penalty cases, it is a frequent occurrence early in the opinion where the court, in so many words, says these 15 assignments of error are unsupported by any argument in the brief, and therefore we don't consider it. So that's my argument here. I'm not making an argument based on the assignments of error, their adequacy or lack thereof. My argument is, my position is there's no supporting argument. There's nothing in here on the merits to say the Court of Appeals talked about the indictment supplanting what preceded it, and Ashby and Brooks support that conclusion. There's nothing in the argument part of the brief, there's no reply brief that in any way touches upon any of that. And to just briefly talk about it today in oral argument, again, I submit it just comes too late. On the merits, it's interesting because the defendant seems to be complaining about something that this court has already expressly made clear is fine. He said at his page 14 of his brief, the indictment essentially disregarded the action of the general district court. Similarly, in the circuit court at page 28 of the appendix, which is part of the motion to quash or amend the indictment, he says, disregarding the general district court's order, the Commonwealth chose to lay before the grand jury an indictment that had not been certified. Well, this court in Moore, which is certainly still good law, there the district court certainly went further than anything here. In Moore, there was a preliminary hearing on two drug charges, and the district court, quote unquote, dismissed those charges. And the Commonwealth then obtained indictments on those charges. The district court certainly went further in favor of the defendant and more than you have anything here. Here, it at least certified on a lesser included offense. And this court in Moore made quite clear that the actions of the Commonwealth were appropriate. It certainly could have been at least as plausibly asserted there that this was a blatant disregard of the district court's dismissal of these charges, but this court found that position unavailing. It seems to me it should be the same conclusion reached here. I do think that this was a direct indictment. My understanding is some jurisdictions in the state, the word direct shows up on the face of the indictment. Some it doesn't. But I think this meets all the criteria for a direct indictment. The Commonwealth did...
Can I ask you this? If this was a direct indictment, then what happened to the charge that was on the warrant?
That was certified?
Yeah.
Well, I think as per the Court of Appeals analysis, it was supplanted. It basically just is no longer part of the mix. I would also say this, at least one of the cases I've cited, and I, to be honest with you, I'm not positive which one it is. It certainly made clear in my brief. It may have been Ashby, but there were certain charges there that were left hanging, so to speak. They were never formed. They weren't non-pros. They just sort of sat there. And the court said, nevertheless, under Brooks v. Payton, that is not something that vitiated what happened here. Brooks v. Payton, by the way, again, I don't think counsel even today has mentioned Brooks v. Payton, so whatever his position might be as to how Brooks v. Payton is distinguishable here, we just don't know. But Brooks v. Payton said in very broad language that where there was an initial indictment charging, I think it was larceny, and then because of some intervening developments in the co-defendant's trial, there was a new indictment charging robbery, that second indictment supplanted the first one, and the statutory speedy trial period began to run from that second one. By the way, counsel today talks about the amendment of the indictment. There was no amendment of an indictment here. There's one and only indictment. You have a certified charge, and you have the one and only indictment on the possession with intent to distribute. Now, counsel has briefly gone into the somewhat related issues of the timeliness of the trial, and he may have also gotten into the Feretta issue, which also is tied in with there. And I'd like to make a few points on that. First, for reasons I pretty much have advanced during this argument, any challenge to the speedy trial ruling of the Court of Appeals, I think, is defaulted. The Court of Appeals essentially defended or upheld the timeliness of the trial on the same principle that the filing of the indictment supplanted what had preceded it, and so therefore the date of the indictment was the date from which the statute began to run. Now, if that conclusion, that premise is right, then there's no question whatever that the trial was timely. It was timely by over a month. Again, for the reasons I've indicated, the defendant's brief doesn't say word one about that analysis, just presents the same argument he'd advanced in the Court of Appeals, and I say that's a default. But again, put that aside. I think plainly there are other defaults here on the speedy trial claim. The hearing of great significance is the one on January 8th, which is also where the Feretta issue arises. And there was a 16-day passage of time between then and the next hearing on January 24th. Defense counsel, in response to questions from the trial judge, explicitly said that 16 days was the one and only period that he was relying on, nothing else before or after. The Court of Appeals, in its own opinion, again said the only thing we're looking at is the 16 days. Everything else is defaulted. He could have challenged that ruling, that default ruling of the Court of Appeals. He did not, so therefore consistent with Williams. For that additional reason, we're limited to the 16 days. By his own specific analysis at trial, we're talking about a period of less than 3 days. I think you have 152 and a fraction days put aside any polling, and by his calculations, this was 155. So that's 16 days. If he loses on that, that's the end of the statutory speedy trial claim. I submit that the Ferretta ruling of the lower court and the court of, and the trial court were both correct. It's important to point out several things. First, the critical hearing is the one on January 8th. While attorney number two, the first one that had to withdraw because of conflict of interest, the attorney number two, I don't have my trusty chronology, must be over there, but I think, if I remember correctly, on January 2nd, he filed two related motions. One, motion to withdraw because he had his own conflict, and two, a motion to continue the case. They come there to court on January 8th. That's the purpose of the hearing. This is unlike the Stockton case, for example, where the defendant made noises about wanting to represent himself. So they scheduled a hearing in circuit court for the very purpose of examining that issue. This was for something else. And by the way, under 192-243, the statutory speedy trial provision, it specifically says that it is told by, quote, a continuance granted on the motion of the accused or his counsel. So we have this motion of the counsel for a continuance that potentially can toll the statute. So this defendant, when they're there for that purpose, interjects, so, well, I'd like to represent myself. But then later, when the judge says, you have an absolute right to do it, but we're here to consider the motion, and I'm going to appoint new counsel, and you can discuss it with him, and then if you want to represent yourself, come back, and if you show that you can properly do so under the constructs of Ferretta, you can. And the trial judge later at trial, again, talked about this absolute right. There was never a denial here of any Ferretta right, but the defendant, in effect, says that he had the right to just blow by the stated nature and function of this hearing on January 8th, and yet Ferretta and numerous other cases I've quoted say that the right of self-representation is not absolute. It's not a license to ignore various procedural and substantive rules of the court. It's not a license to ignore the court's calendar. It was there for a purpose that had nothing to do with Ferretta. Plus, when this issue comes up about the who they're going to get as the new attorney, Harrington pipes up and says, well, what about Brad Woodbridge? Is he available? Not exactly the words of someone just chomping at the bit to represent himself. And at the end of the hearing, he says, well, who's this delay going to be charged to? I have the same observation. I mean, there's plenty here to suggest this is a very manipulative defendant. I mean, for example, at pages 311 to 314 of the appendix, the trial judge, alluding to two recent U.S. Supreme Court cases dealing with whether the defendant is apprised of a plea agreement offer, asked him very straightforwardly, have you gotten any offers here? And he persisted, I haven't gotten any written offers. And this goes back and forth. He said, but have you...
Mr. Anderson, let me ask one question about the facts. After the defendant raises the issue of what about whoever this attorney is, and they have this discussion, he objects to the trial being continued. He tells the judge, I want to have a trial today. So doesn't that negate all of the conversation about whether he was participating in the discussion of having an attorney advise him and or represent him?
No, Justice Powell, I don't think it does, because the purpose of that hearing was for something very distinct. It was to consider the defense attorney's motion to continue the case and to withdraw. And the motion for the continuance was hardly even necessary, because if he has to withdraw, then by definition, there's going to be a continuance.
Unless the defendant represents himself.
Right. What I'm saying is the defendant does not have the right to say, irrespective of why the court is here today, I'm going to insist on representing myself. I mean, again, this is not an absolute right. I've quoted cases saying that it's not a license to ignore all sorts of procedural and substantive rules of law. I submit that that's what you have. Again, you also have You have to look at the record as a whole. There are plenty of cases saying just that. If you look at the record as a whole, his position that day, at the very least, was equivocal. If you permit me just to finish up my answer.
I think you've answered Justice Powell's question and your time has
Thank
expired.
You.
Thank you. Rebuttal, 1 minute and 53 seconds.
Counsel, how do you distinguish Brooks?
Your Honor, well, first of all, I distinguish Brooks because that was a null pros in the general district court followed by a direct indictment. I did happen to read that case, and Ashby as well, and frankly all the cases that were cited in, by the Commonwealth in my briefs. So there is a difference. This case was not null pros in the general district court. There is statutory authority. If that occurs, then the Commonwealth can bring a direct indictment. This case, the warrant stayed alive. I agree. It wasn't an amended indictment. It was an amended something because, I guess, I don't know, when it ceases to become a warrant, it becomes an indictment. But somewhere in there, the Commonwealth made such an amendment.
Your objection is that the first charges are just floating out there somewhere, that there were never no pros.
No, ma'am. They're not floating. They became an indictment for possession with intent to distribute. And I understand why you're having trouble wrapping your head around this, because it hasn't happened before. It hasn't happened in any of the cases cited by the Commonwealth. And that's why I didn't go back, because I think the Court of Appeals was just wrong, to be quite honest, in its reliance on Ashby. Because this wasn't a second charge to supplant the first charge. It was taking the first charge and the Commonwealth on its own motion making an amendment. There's another thing the Commonwealth could have done. Indict on what went forward, what the judge certified.
Question. Why do you call that an amendment? Why wouldn't it just be a new indictment? It seems like the only reason is because nothing ever happened to those other charges. They weren't presented to the grand jury.
Well, I think that I would call it an amendment because it started saying one thing, which was possession, and by the time it got to the grand jury, it was possession with intent to distribute. Therefore, changes were made, and I would call those an amendment.
But why do you think it's an amendment to the warrant as opposed to a new indictment?
I'm sorry?
Why do you think it is an amendment to the warrant as opposed to a separate direct indictment?
Well, I guess it goes back to process, because my understanding of process is if whatever comes out of the general district court, in other words, the warrant that came out of the general district court could come out in whatever form. It can be null pros, it can be come out as charged, as it could have been in this case, or I guess comes out as the amended instrument, in this case, by the general district court judge. What I don't see in the code and what I don't see in the case law in Ashby or Brooks or anything is where the Commonwealth can interpose itself to change that instrument. It can do so many other things, including prepare 10 more direct indictments if it wants.
Well, let me ask you this, because my experience has been that the indictment is drafted by the Commonwealth's attorney. It's completely separate from the warrant. And so how can you say that the indictment, which is created by the Commonwealth's attorney, is an amendment of the warrant as opposed to being a direct indictment? That's only your characterization of what happened, it seems like.
Well, I think I'm also relying on the code to some degree. In other words, if you are arrested on an offense and that offense goes to circuit court, it seems like the vehicle for that is the preliminary hearing or waiver of preliminary hearing, and you end up in circuit court. But the original charging document, whatever it is, in this case, possession of intent, amended down to possession by the district court judge, is that vehicle. In other words, it carries, I guess, on its face, on the warrant, what the charge is. And once certified, the code allows that certified charge is what goes up and becomes an indictment. Now, obviously, all the case law we've read has to do with this, and says there's a whole lot of other things can happen, including, as you point out, and I wonder if the defendant in Ashby was on bond or not, because there are these other charges that were never presented to the grand jury, but that's not what we have in this case, because that charge was presented to the grand jury, but was not presented as, the charge that was certified by the circuit court. And if I could just kind of tie it all together.
May I ask a question about Brooks, Chief?
Chief, may I ask a question?
You indicate that Brooks is different because the original charge was null prost in general district court. Was that your distinction as to why Brooks does not apply?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, let's pick up with Brooks when the first indictment is issued. As I understand it, that indictment
was just out there somewhere. He was never carried forward to trial on that, and then he was indicted again. So why isn't that basically the same process that we have here? Your document, your warrant is out there somewhere, but there is another indictment, or there is an indictment.
Well, and I think that the analysis in Brooks is then talking about actually where speedy trial starts because of that, when it's served and when it's not, and what rights you have procedurally, whether you have a right to a preliminary hearing or not. But I think directly on your question, again, the new indictment, if you will, is the Commonwealth exercising its statutory authority to prepare an indictment as it can. So that charge in Brooks was now a charge, and then the subsequent indictments were charges prepared by the Commonwealth either to charge the offense separately. Now, recall that what happens then, if the Commonwealth is to do that, in other words, if you're indicted for something and you still have, if you're arrested on a warrant still being held, you're still entitled, and the code is clear, to have your case remanded back to General District Court for a preliminary hearing. So I think there's an acknowledgement of the distinction between the arrest on the warrant and the actual, I guess, service and ultimate arrest on the indictment. And when they can coexist, yes, but it doesn't change, I think, substantive rights of the defendant. In this case, we're not talking about preliminary. He did have a preliminary hearing. But I think then the next step is what happens after that preliminary hearing. And in his case, obviously the argument would be nothing statutory.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. The court is adjourned.
All rise.